I'm turning this evening for our starting point to the first book of Kings, chapter 4 and verse 24. 1 Kings, chapter 4, verse 24. And it's about King Solomon reigning over all Israel, for he had dominion over all the region on this side the river, from Tiphsah even to Azza, over all the kings on this side the river, and he had peace on all sides round about him. And our subject tonight is Christ in the temple. But I start back here in 1 Kings chapter 4. Solomon is king. Now he's been king at this point about 2 years. This is the highest point Israel ever reached in her history, after King David and under Solomon. We're looking at the united kingdoms of Judah and Israel. After Solomon, as you know, the kingdom was to break up into two. This is the finest point. The population was never larger than it was here, at least for the united kingdom, the two kingdoms together. It was the most illustrious time in Israel's history. There was such prosperity that if we understand the texts correctly, there was no such thing as a poor person in the land. Everyone had their homestead, their small holding. Everyone was prosperous and everyone was extremely happy, materially speaking. That was the state of the land in the first years, in much of Solomon's reign. Now, there was peace, not just because the enemies round about were conquered, but they were all actually subject to Solomon and Israel. The kingdoms round about maintained their own nation statehood, and yet they were all subservient to Solomon. On very good terms, what he derived from them, he paid for, and so on. It wasn't a kind of cruel or oppressive subjection, but they all came to his court, and they all succumbed to him and followed him. There'd never been a state or a condition like it. It was Israel at her highest, and that sort of thing we'll see. Look at just a few verses before I move on to chapter 5, which is where we're really going. That 24th verse gives the extent of the dominion. Verse 25, and Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and sentiments to that effect are repeated. It was the universal condition of the land. I could go back to verse 22. Look at some of these interesting things. Solomon's provision for one day was, and then there's the long list of what was provided to the royal court in terms of flour and meal and oxen and so on. And it's been estimated that all that would have fed 3,000 people daily. What was Solomon doing with 3,000 guests constantly at his court? Well, his court was virtually the center of the world, you might say. People came, and royal companies came from far and near to eat at his table and to receive wisdom and instruction. It's quite an amazing situation had developed. And this is the provisions for the luncheons, as it were, at the royal court every day. Even those are noted down here. And then in verse 26, rather interesting statistic, we won't stay with these. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. There is a problem here, because in the parallel passage in 2 Chronicles, the figure given is 4,000. So, of course, nowadays people instantly say, well, one of the figures is wrong. It's either 40,000 or it's 4,000, it can't be both. And so they speak about copyists' errors and mistakes and so on, and 40,000 horses being too incredible for words. But you should never be in a hurry to correct scripture. There is invariably, not always, but there is invariably an explanation emerges before we go speaking about mistakes and errors and things of that kind. And here it's been pointed out by numerous writers that because there was something like 6 million in the population, and there were very few large towns, mostly small settlements of 100 houses and an absolute maximum 500 to 1,000 people in each settlement, this really only works out at something like 5 to 10 horses a settlement if you look at it nationally. And if there was some kind of a territorial army, which is what it would have been, with a chariot and a certain amount of equipment in each settlement, in each place, that could have been summoned with infantrymen from the village, from the community, that would be about right. You'd get a figure like 40,000 horses in a dominant state like Israel at the time. The problem comes with the 4,000 in the later reference, the Second Chronicles, and that might be accounted for by the fact that in that case they're talking about the forces at court rather than spread around the country. But there may be an explanation of that kind, and much more likely than there to be mistakes in the manuscripts with all the care of the Masoretes and so on. But anyway, there's an interesting statistic there in verse 26. Now look at verse 29. And God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much. There'd never been anyone like him. He's only 22, and he seems to know so much with this God-given understanding and largeness of heart. He was a young man of extraordinary compassion and accommodation for knowledge. And it says in verse 30 that his wisdom excelled all the wisdom of the children of the East country and all the wisdom of Egypt. Don't you see that this implies, and it's stated more plainly later on, that he was constantly giving public lectures. This wasn't wisdom bottled up with him or confined in the royal court. This was wisdom that was spread far and wide. Scholars came, as well as national leaders, and they would listen to his lectures. We're told a little later they were on zoology and botany, and in Ecclesiastes we discover that they were also on archaeology and architecture and all kinds of things. And psychology and philosophy, he lectured it all. But his reputation was so great in the world of the day, and his name above the name of all the great scholars that had been so identified in the world. And you read this in verses 30 and 31, he was wiser than all men. And there is the list of the Intellectual Hall of Fame. And down in verse 32, he spake 3,000 proverbs. That's very interesting. There were about 800 in the book of Proverbs. I can't tell you whether that means only 800 of Solomon's proverbs were inspired, but only 800 were ever intended by God to be in the book of Proverbs. There were many more. His literary output was tremendous. And you read here that he wrote 1,500 songs. Well, we only have one, the Song of Solomon. I wonder if the others were as long. Maybe one or two secretly nestling in the Psalms. I can't tell you that. But then verse 33, he spake of trees, from the cedar tree that is in Lebanon, which is richly suggestive. He didn't just describe the tree, He may have known almost as much about the inner workings of the tree than we know today. Even to the hyssop that springeth out of the wall, large plants and tiny plants. He spake also of beasts and of fowl and of creeping things and of fishes. And there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth, from all kings, which means to me that they sent their scholars, which had heard of his wisdom. So that's Solomon. And I emphasize this tonight only to say, and this is the harrowing thought, Solomon fell. A man with such wisdom and such an intellect and such a memory store for detailed and sophisticated knowledge could fall. That's a very solemn thought, dear friends. And here tonight, I expect most of us, I do hope so, are saved people. And we know the Lord. And some may be friends who've accomplished a good deal already in life. And some may be people who are quite powerfully gifted intellectually. You can fall. Don't let Satan whisper in our ear, well, somebody who's made it as far as you have, or done as well as you have, can't so easily fall, surely. Didn't you have more sense, more balance, more understanding? Haven't you in your profession been taught to look at things in a professional manner and a careful way? And that's how you look at all life. And you're saved. Surely you're safe. No. We're only safe in the Lord. And there we're safe as a rock. But we're not safe on account of any qualification in us. And Solomon reminds us of that. Great as he was. So I hope you don't mind striking a note of care. You've never read in the Bible such amazing things about anyone as you read about Solomon, yet he fell. So we all need daily prayer and lay hold on the scripture and the gathering of ourselves together in worship and the support of one another, as none of us above all the provisions and the means of grace that God has given. And Solomon reminds us of that. I could spend a lot of time talking about why he fell. That's not going to be my purpose tonight, but you get a big insight in the book of Ecclesiastes, where he tells us, frankly, here are all the things I set out to do to give myself fulfillment and happiness and satisfaction. You see, Solomon was provided for so marvelously with everything, the legacy left to him by David, peace, subduing of all his ferocious neighbors, wealth and provisions to build the house of God, people around him, even from the Gentile nations like Hiram and the Sidonians, who would come and say, let us help you. He had so much help, so many advantages, such an education, such an example, such experience, even as a young man, he began to trust those things over much. And Ecclesiastes tells us, I had all this knowledge, I had all this wealth, and I used it to get satisfaction from the creature rather than from the Creator. That's the reason for his fall. Could be the reason for our fall. We serve the Lord, but then we started to be attracted to give too much time and attention, too much to the home, or to clothing, or to some possessions, or to some interesting pursuit, all legitimate things, but not in excess. And they snared us. That's just a little insight into Solomon, but there's much more to it, of course, than that. And we're looking here at his output. And verse 34, to conclude the chapter, there came of all people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all kings of the earth, which had heard of his wisdom. He was an international celebrity, but he would fall. Now let's go on to chapter 5, the provision of plenty for Solomon. Just a quick look at some of these things first. Verse 1, Hiram, king of Tyre, sent his servants unto Solomon, for he had heard that they had anointed him king. I think Hiram was a believer in the Lord, one true God. That's often doubted. He's a Gentile, of course, but he's the first person to send his respects to Solomon when Solomon becomes king. And he's got all the rocks up there in his territory, up in Sidonia, the stone, the huge slabs of white stone that would lay the foundation to the temple. And Solomon sent to Hiram, saying, he's very frank with him, because he's a fellow believer, I think. Thou knowest how that David, my father, could not build an house unto the name of the Lord his God for the wars which were about him on every side. It's not a practical thing. David was a man of war. He had to be. That was his calling, to defend Israel and to bring peace. Because the temple that would represent Christ had to be built in circumstances of peace. It was a great symbol of Christ, the Prince of Peace, who would bring peace. It couldn't be built amidst war, not just for practical reasons, but for symbolic reasons. And so David was denied any part in the building of the temple. His son Solomon would be a man of peace. And for the symbol of peace, that must be. And Solomon divulges this to Hiram and then proposes that he uses materials from his region and that Hiram provides them, and furthermore the experts and the tradespeople to handle them. Verse 5, and behold, I purpose to build a house unto the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord spake unto David my father. Verse 6, hew me cedar trees out of Lebanon and people to manage them and to handle them, and so on. So now the house of God is going to be built, the house of peace, and it's done under God's direction. And if you go down to verse 13, because of the prosperity in Israel, and because of the fact that everyone had their small holding and was blissfully happy and successful in their farming endeavours, there were no labourers available. There was certainly no underclass. And so for this great work of felling and haulage and everything else, there had to be national conscription. This has been studied, and people have said, cynical people have said, look, this temple was built on forced labour, slave labour. There's no such thing. The nearest you can get to it is in a time of war, when a nation has to call up forces for its defence, for a noble cause like that. Well, this was a noble cause, the building of the temple. But people have to be conscripted, because otherwise it can't be done. And so verse 13, King Solomon raised a levy, a conscription, out of all Israel, 30,000 men. And there were more than were raised, and also foreign nationals, Gentiles, sent them to Lebanon. It's amazing what they brought out of Lebanon, not only the timber, but further on from Sidon, these great pieces of stone. The temple foundation and the core of the walls would all be of stone. In excavations in Jerusalem over the years, the last 120 odd years, some amazing things have been found. Some of the foundation stones of the temple are 20, 25 feet long and up to 12 feet wide, 8, 9 feet deep. Great trunks of white stone without fissure or crack, so enormous. And these were all brought down from Sidon. And they were shaped and prepared to be foundation and wall stones for the temple where they were found, from the great stone quarries. There wasn't to be any tool work in Jerusalem or at the temple site. The symbol of peace was to be built in peace, without the sound of iron and all the rest of it. So they were fashioned, and then they were brought, because you know how they were brought. You've possibly seen pictures of how they transported these great slabs of stone. They would fell many, many trees and smooth them off so that they had scores and hundreds of rollers. And they'd roll those great pieces of stone 70, 80, 100 miles if necessary and get them in position. What a feat of engineering. But the whole temple structure had to be stone, and even though it was going to be covered, some of it buried because it was foundational, others covered by timber and then gold and so on, we'll see. But in spite of that, it had to be perfect slabs of stone with no defect, no fissure, not likely to crumble or crack, split. That's how it had to be done. This was a massive piece of symbolism, and it had to be done according to God's given instructions. And those instructions depicted Christ, the Saviour, who would come from glory and would be the everlasting God. So stone, durable, invincible, invulnerable, unbreakable stone, in all its purity, uncracked, unspoiled, had to be brought, representing the coming of the Holy One from glory. Of course, they didn't know the details of how Christ would come. They were given the details of temple building to teach them the mysteries of the future, that God, by some means, was going to provide a way of salvation. So the stone was brought and laid in position. And then you get the construction of the temple itself. And I turn to chapter 6. Time is speeding on, and we must be quick. First verse of chapter 6 is one of the most important verses of the Bible, but it actually has nothing to do with our study tonight. And it came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziph, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord. That verse is the crucial, essential, pivotal verse for the whole of Old Testament chronology and dating. Everything works from this verse. This is the time signature of the Old Testament. This is the basis of our understanding how many years ago it was that Abraham lived, that the patriarchs lived, that the kings lived, and so on. We've got a lot of chronological information, and it's this verse that draws it all together. But that's for another study, another time. A precious, precious verse which enables us to know just where we are in Old Testament history. But verse 2, this is our theme tonight, and the house which King Solomon built for the Lord, and the size is given, and the porches that were added on. Size is interesting. It's controversial. We don't know exactly what verse 2 means, because you can only assume that a cubit was 18 inches. A lot of people seem to produce a lot of evidence that for the description of the temple, it was probably 21 inches. So the temple, not including its extra portions, like the Holy of Holies that was built on, and various other things, and all the storerooms, was 90 feet by 30 feet by 45 feet high. Now, the tabernacle here, from floor to ceiling, is 38 feet. So that gives you some idea of height. But it may have been bigger, 105 feet long by 35 feet wide by 52 feet high, depending on the size of a cubit, which we can't be certain about. But anyway, the porch is added there in verse 3, and there were some narrow lights in verse 4, and chambers built about, which I won't deal with. Coming down to verse 7, the house, when it was in building, was built of stone, with all the work being done off-site. Stone, strong, eternal, you might say, invincible, representing holiness and eternity of Christ. And then comes the wood, verse 9. He covered the house with beams and boards of cedar. And then there's a little more of the chambers, and there's more about the wood, a shade later on, in verse 15. Boards of cedar, floor of the house, and the walls of the ceiling, covered on the inside with wood, and covered the floor with planks of fir. So now everything is concealed by cedar wood, plus a fir covering on the common floors. Refinement. You start with stone. Wonderful. All the virtues of stone. Then you think of the disadvantages. Hard, cold. We don't want that in the symbol. We don't want a stone place. So it's covered with cedar. Fragrant cedar. Strong, incapable of rot. Giving a mellow sound in the building. No harsh, ringing tones. And above all, carvable, because it's going to have illustrations, visual aids, even before it's overlaid with gold. All really can be referred to Christ. Christ comes, yes, holiness, eternity, perfection, but clothes himself in a body of flesh, refined, warm, approachable, beautiful. With the carvings, the buds and the flowers. Can't you see, friends, what are buds and flowers? The symbolism is obvious. Promises and fulfillment. That's what it's all about. It's a temple of promises and fulfillment. But it's still not enough. Stone, we want that. Fragrant wood, we want that. But it's not sufficient to depict Christ. Now you cover all of it so that you can't see any of the wood. not even the fir planks on the floor. You cover it all with layer upon layer upon layer of hammered gold leaf to signify the preciousness and the costliness of God sending his Son to suffer and to die for sinners, to pay the price of salvation on Calvary, sending the perfect one to deserve heaven for us. So you've got costliness. It's all there in the symbolism of the temple. Christ is in the temple. No wonder when they scoffed at Christ and they said, well, I won't go into the details, but they scoffed at Christ and he said, speaking of his body, destroy this temple and I will raise it up again in 3 days. And that's what he did. There was Solomon's temple, the first temple. After that was destroyed, there was Herod's temple, the second temple. A lot of people want the temple to be rebuilt. And they say silly things like, when Christ will come, the temple will be rebuilt. The temple has been rebuilt in 3 days at the resurrection of Christ. He is the temple. The temple is just a picture of Christ, a wonderful symbol of Christ. And the old has passed away, and reformation has taken place. A new covenant has replaced the old, and Christ is the temple. To say you want the temple back, the temple couldn't save, it could only illustrate salvation. Now we have the real temple. Dear friends, as we come quickly to conclusion, one or two things that I must direct you to. Verse 23, and within the oracle he made 2 cherubims of olive tree. The olive, of course, represents the tree of peace. Each 10 cubits high. These are the cherubims of justice. No hypocrisy in the temple, which is Christ. But then further, because there's not time to talk about that, verse 31, and for the entering of the oracle, just follow this and we come to conclusion. For the entering of the oracle, the Holy of Holies, he made doors of olive tree. But that's not all. You discovered they're covered with gold. They must have been so massive and so heavy, those doors. And the lintel and side posts were a fifth part of the wall. In other words, a 5-faced lintel. And I'll tell you in a nutshell what's going on. The aperture between the temple and the Holy of Holies had 2 sets of double doors. We read the details in due course, but not tonight. The doors were not hung on hinges. They were hung or seated on gold pins. One of the pairs of doors opened inward into the temple itself, and the other pair of doors opened in the other direction into the Holy of Holies. The pair of doors that opened into the temple were always open. The pair of doors that opened into the Holy of Holies were always shut. Firmly shut. Over the doors there was a great curtain of gold tapestry. It was operated by golden chains. We read about those. Once a year, the golden chain would be operated a little, the curtain would part a little, and the high priest and the high priest alone would open the inner door and go into the Holy of Holies. That was the procedure. Once a year. What an extraordinary thing. The doors that opened into the temple said, "The way of salvation is open." And it was. Their sins could be forgiven. The sacrifices of the animals taught them that a sacrifice was coming one day when all sin would be done away with. And if they trusted that God would make a way, their sins could be forgiven. The outer doors said the way to salvation and to heaven is open. The inner doors said, but how it's going to be done is not yet revealed. Not until Christ comes. Not until Christ comes. There's an Irish lady, wife of a clergyman in the 19th century, wrote a hymn for little children to educate them as to how this represented the crucifixion and the ascension of Christ. You know the first verse, "The golden gates are lifted up, the curtain rises, the doors are opened wide, and Christ enters in to his Father's side. The way is now open." The inner doors leading to the temple, open, you can be forgiven. The doors leading to the Holy of Holies, still a secret. How it would be done, that Christ would come and suffer and die on Calvary. And all that is beautifully set out for us in the letter to the Hebrews and in chapter 9. And when I've read this, you will say to me, why didn't you just read that in the first place? Hebrews 9. "Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary." And down to verse 3. "And after the second veil, the tabernacle which is called the holiest of all, which had the golden censer and the ark of the covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant, and over it the cherubims of glory, shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly." Listen to this. "Now when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle," the main tabernacle, temple, "accomplishing the service of God. But into the second went the high priest alone, once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people." The Holy Ghost, this signifier, this is the lesson of the double doors, that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, published, while as the first tabernacle, the temple, was yet standing, which was a figure, an illustration, for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices, that could not make him that did the service perfect as pertaining to the conscience. They weren't effective. Verse 11, "But Christ being come, and high priest of good things to come, by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, it was himself. He is the third tabernacle, neither by the blood of goats and of calves, but by his own blood. He entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us." A prophecy of Christ's work. Wonderful things, dear friends. They had it all. in symbols. Just one last remark. You may think of the bronze basin or laver for the washing of the priests and the high priests, and the many, many smaller bowls for the washing of the hands and the utensils and the priests. And you think of that gated, walled off Holy of Holies. See how they were taught to worship with such reverence and godly fear. Think of that. When you see what's going on in the churches today, and the crazy worldliness, and the noise and the racket, and the pandemonium of so-called modern worship, it is nothing, nothing like the standard of the Bible. Approaching a holy God. Yes, we can have great joy and happiness and mirth. Always refinement, always reverence, always care. What a come down. They say, you know, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today and forever. You'd never know it. Wish we could put them all into some sort of a time capsule and transport them back and show them the days of mighty reverence and washings. We don't need all that now. If we respect him from our hearts and honour him, maintain reverence as well as happiness and joy. But really, today's generation need a big dose of Old Testament solemnity to show them the error and the sinfulness of what's happening today. Anyway, come back to this, because this is a view of Christ. The stone, the cedar, the gold. Wonderful picture of Christ, our perfect Messiah,